This is Monocle on Design, a show where we discuss everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. On today's episode, we highlight some of the winners featured in the fourth edition of the Monocle Design Awards. These are in Monocle magazine's May issue, which is on newsstands now. There are 50 winners, and we recognise some of the best designers and brands based across the globe and that are making truly outstanding work in their field. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. Hello and welcome to today's show. What makes good design? That's the question that we have sought to answer in the fourth edition of the Monocle Design Awards. This annual survey of the industry's finest work features everything from leading architectural projects and the best in furniture production to community building initiatives and top graphic works. I am joined in the studio by Monocle's associate editor, Grace Charlton, to talk about the winners. I mean, Grace, hi, welcome. Hello.
Hi.
We sifted through what felt like hundreds of potential winners to narrow it down to, I guess, our top 50 design award winners. I mean, I guess I want to get your take on it. This is the first time we've sort of worked in depth on this. What jumped out to you about the Monocle Design Awards? What makes them special? What do you think should make somebody want to win one?
I think the international range that we went for is pretty impressive, if I do say so myself.
31 countries.
31 countries. Also the range in terms of how big a studio is. It could just be, you know, one of the biggest brands or just a student from Lund University.
Yeah, I mean, we're going from Fritz Hansen in Denmark, which is a household name, through to, you know, there's a best urban landscape in Sydney, Australia, through to, I guess, winners in Sweden, like a student, as you mentioned, Albin Jonsson from Lund University. I think what's also significant is the fact that we do tap into this network of editors and contributors. We had James Chambers, our Asia editor at large, do an interview with Studio Make, this Thai firm. We also had Fiona Wilson, who runs our Japan office, reach out to an amazing designer behind a new graphic campaign for a brand called Cars. So we've kind of got this spread, and I think that's, like you said, I think that's what kind of makes it fun and that's what makes it exciting. These are case studies, not only just best in feel, but I guess also the best in terms of a global reach or global inspiration. The idea is that, yeah, you can be sitting in a design studio in Perth, Western Australia, and pick this up and see some amazing design work in Japan, through to a project in Tanzania, which was called Mariam's Library by Parallel Studio, who are based in the Gulf. And it's like you have this amazing cross-pollination of inspiration that you can then, you know, hopefully take and apply to your own work. I mean, I guess in terms of characteristics, were there anything you were looking for when you were kind of picking out some of your potential candidates?
For me, it's always craft and a really sort of deep understanding of quality and the time it takes to get there. I think, I don't know, there's also obviously the Monocle take on design, which is, you know, maybe a little bit more minimalist, a little bit more pared back and less trends driven, if you will. What about you? What did you personally think?
Because I think picking up on that, I guess it's a focus on, I guess, clarity and longevity. And I think sometimes being less focused on, I guess, a trend, you know, whether that's, you know, bubbly forms or, you know, the latest, hottest materials, and instead focusing on things that will stand up to the test of time, you know, and it's a debate we've had time and time again on Monocle on Design, but how things stand up to the test of time, not being afraid, I guess, to carry the mark of their time, but also, you know, relying on products and design decisions that, I guess, carry through the ages. One of those is a willingness to embrace the environment, and we see this with project after project. In Guatemala, we featured Miller Hull's design for the US embassy there, and that was all about, I guess, not relying on new technologies to cool a building, but using Brise Soleil, positioning the building so that it made the most of natural breezes, so that it faced onto green and verdant courtyards, which naturally cool structures. I think the other one for me is just a willingness to elevate the everyday, and the idea that, you know, the objects we come into contact with should be beautiful. They should be things that we want to touch and hold and treasure and hang on to forever. And I think that comes back to your point on trends. And it should be said, we've had a number of winners come in and talk to us for this show, but this does lend itself nicely, a beautiful segue off the cuff for the first interview on today's show and one of our winners. Tell us who we're going to hear from.
I spoke to Lily Frolicher, who is one of the co-founders of Invisible Collection. They're a French company. They began as an online marketplace to make contemporary interior design more readily available to the public. They have offices all over the world. They have two in New York. They currently have a pop-up in LA. They have another one in London, another one in Paris. They're looking to Asia. So they do a lot. They work as well with, you know, big French institutions like Chanel's the 19M, and Mobilier National. So they're very busy. And she took the time to come in, which was really appreciated.
And quickly, before we jump into this, tell us a little bit about what they do. So they commission designers to create collectible works of design, won the award for Champions of Craft. How are they, I guess, a champion of craft?
Every designer they choose to work with needs to have really close relations with artisans and, you know, workshops, because one of their big, I guess, unique selling point is that whatever they sell needs to be bespoke. You can't do that if you're just mass producing furniture. They're also very French in their way of, you know, focusing on quality and construction, and I think tapping into their country's sort of heritage when it comes to craft, and selling that all around the world, which is very nice for us.
We're talking about the people that want to have pieces in their home. I think, you know, there's a danger at the moment where everything can kind of start to look the same, and people might question, what's the significance of craft, or why should we care about how things are made? Why should I pay a little bit more for something that looks a little bit distinct? And I think that's maybe the answer right there. It's like, we want our homes, we want our spaces to tell stories about who we are. And I think sometimes finding a piece that has this craft element, that has this moment of distinction, that has something that engages you or excites you, is really, really important. So let's hear your discussion with Lily Frohlicher now.
The reason why we built Invisible Collection was because of the realization that most of the beautiful houses that we were seeing all over design magazines like, you know, AD or other publications, were actually pieces that had been designed by an interior designer for the house that they were designing, so for a specific client. And these pieces were not accessible to the rest of the world because they had been designed for this unique client, made with an incredible artisan, but there was no channel of distribution for these pieces.
And you mentioned artisans, but for me, you're a lot about craft. I was wondering if you could talk about how you go about selecting the designers that you choose to champion.
We do a lot of research. My business partner, Isabel, specifically spends most of her time selecting these designers, meeting with designers, and just discovering new emerging talents. The way that we select designers is very organic. We typically only work with designers who we feel inspirations that we understand, have their unique aesthetic, work with craftsmen that can accommodate for bespoke and custom requests, typically working with people whose work we think will pass the test of time. Those who hopefully will become, you know, the Jean-Michel Franck or the Jean Royer of tomorrow.
You are a recipient of a Monocle Design Award. When we spoke before that, you mentioned how the craft aspect helped turn around these companies who didn't know when their next, like, paycheck would be coming from. You've been able to give these companies a way to extend the production beyond just a bespoke project.
The designers and the ateliers were really spending so much time and so much creativity and really all of their talents into designing one upholstery piece or maybe just curtains for a project. And they would be working for several weeks or months on this one piece. But as you mentioned, it wasn't really done at scale at all, which we thought was quite sad because it meant that they couldn't necessarily invest in the development of their ateliers, continue hiring, and it was very difficult for them to train new people who would make sure that their craft is preserved over time. It's really important that we give them that level of orders every quarter or every year so that they could really grow their business. We work with over 300 ateliers. And all of them make to measure, make by hand. There's no mass production. And that really is the essence of our business model.
And like you said, you're very international, but there is maybe more of a heritage and appreciation for that in France, would you say? Is that fair? You've got Mobilier Neuf in there that you work with, as well as like Le 19ème. A lot of workshops to be able to tap into.
We're incredibly lucky. And when we created Invisible Collection, we thought that we would have the top 20 or top 100 designers from each country. And it is true that there's so much talent out there everywhere. But in France, we're really, really lucky to have a whole industry that is built around craftsmanship. Of course, also because of the luxury fashion industry. And actually, when you look at it, you realize that most of the ateliers that we work with in design design are also the same ateliers that haute couture brands and luxury brands work with. So there's a huge crossover there. And it's a great honor for us to be working with the ateliers of the 19M that you mentioned from Chanel. And it's so wonderful that the design community can benefit from these incredible expertise and these incredible know-hows that have been developed for haute couture specifically and can now be applied to interiors.
You started as an online business and now you have outposts in Paris, New York and London, and Marylebone actually, not too far from here. I also saw this morning in my inbox that you're hosting a Thierry Lemaire showcase in New York. How is it for you to have these like physical outposts?
Reason why we created Invisible Collection online, I think there were two reasons. One, as founders, we're very international and there was no way that we were going to create a gallery that wasn't offering the furniture to an international clientele. We wanted to be able to offer furniture to everyone immediately without being restricted by borders, and the only way to do that was online. We just recognized that there was so much talent and so many designers that were creating and manufacturing these pieces without having a channel of distribution, that we knew there was no way that we would be able to produce and hold as much stock as we would need in a physical space. So the online world was a no-brainer for us. That being said, Isabel and I come from the luxury fashion world and we're obsessed with clienteling and client experience and building personal relationships with our clients. And so we actually immediately had pop-ups, created physical experiences. In 2023, we organized 100 events all over the world over the past 7 years, from Aspen to the Hamptons to Dubai to Milan. But we also felt that it would make a lot of sense for us to have permanent homes. And that's why we opened 5 showrooms. So we have 2 in New York, which offer really different experiences. One is in a beautiful Upper East Side townhouse, and it's just, I hope, a very, very lovely place to go for coffee and to experience the way of life. The second one is a penthouse, which is the highest residence outside of Asia and is just like the coolest place ever. Every time we create a space, we really want to imagine it like a home where people feel welcome and where people can really experience the furniture.
That was Lily Frodisher from Invisible Collection. Nick, you're up next. Who did you speak to from Tamart?
I spoke to Amos Goldrick, who is the founder of Tamart, which is a new furniture firm that's just been set up, actually launched at Salone del Mobile the other week. I think what was really special to me, and it's kind of maybe building on some of those threads that you've got in the Invisible Collection there, it's about objects and furniture and design carrying this level of meaning that I guess makes us want to hold on to things, makes us want to surround ourselves with them. And what was really special about this story was Amos's parents, Tamara and Arthur, were both architects and designers, active from the 50s until the 80s. They created all these amazing interior and architectural projects, and each of them was furnished with bespoke furniture. There were all these custom-made pieces for projects. And when they passed away, Amos was going through their studio and found hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of drawings created by his parents for these projects. Over the past decade, he's sort of been working through them, and there's this emotional connection that you start to develop with your parents, seeing their drawings on page, seeing their prototypes developed, and it paved the way for him to ultimately start to produce these as a line of furniture. Coming back to that story thread, this is a man that's telling the story of his parents through recreations of their own furniture pieces that they designed. For some of them, he had actual working drawings. For some of them, he only had sketches or ideas that he had to then build upon. He's essentially translated these to products that you can now have in your own home. And he's taken the idea that, you know, each of these were imbued with a sense of place because they were made for a specific project. And he's imbued them with a sense of place in the sense that he is making them now in the UK where he's based. These are projects from across the globe, but everything is now made here in the UK. So I had a little bit of a chat to him, I guess, about his parents' story, but ultimately, I guess, we discussed the actual production and what people can get their hands on now from Tamart, who won Best New Brand.
Having parents that are kind of designers, I grew up knowing maybe 10 projects that they were involved in, but then I discovered dozens more. And the archive consists of hundreds of amazing drawings, photographs and negatives and slides and sketchbooks and jewelry and textile design. I guess I was overwhelmed by the diversity of it, but I didn't realize then the magnitude of it. It's been a process probably connected to the grieving process. It was a kind of a shocking period, losing both of them within sort of 18 months. And it feels like Tamart is a sort of a stage within a cycle that I went through. It's a journey of rediscovery, of discovering my parents, their body of work. It's the final sort of stop or element within this journey. And now a new journey starts with the launch.
You know, you talked about discovery and rediscovery there. When you're going through this archive of drawings and their old works, was the initial, I guess, curiosity stemming from architecture and what they did as architects? When did the realization that there might be an opportunity to tell their stories through furniture come into play?
It was imagined kind of hundreds of drawings all rolled up. So the first stage was really to kind of assess what's there. And with the help of a friend that had an archive of other architects, it took a couple of years of just researching, cataloging them, flattening them, making sure that they're protected. And then through that process, it was that discovery of the projects. And with all their projects, they've always designed all the furniture that went into them. None of the furniture was ever mass produced.
How do you take those drawings and then start to produce them at scale now? These were all created specifically for projects. How do you then translate that to a brand?
It was a lot of what if and what if. Oh, we can do that. Oh, it took a couple of years to actually going ahead with it. Some of the furniture I have an emotional connection to because they were at the house. So that was the obvious choice.
As in terms of what to produce?
Yes. There's two. The claw lounge chair that was at the house. And my father always referred to it as my mum's chair. So I used to call my parents by their first name. So it was Tammy's chair. So that kind of stuck with me. And I knew that that had to be in the first collection. And then there's the central stool. That's a three-leg stool that my mum designed at Central School in London between 51 and 56. And we had the only available original, which we showed it in Milan as well. She made it by hand, and it's got the mistakes and the corrections and things. So I knew that those two had to be there. Going through and with the wonderful team behind Tamart, you start making kind of commercial decisions of thinking what could sell, what's interesting, but you start to develop a family of products. And because all of their kind of designs were always site-specific or location-specific, we started to look at it as families. So there was the Claw collection. So that originated from a penthouse that was designed for Sir Charles Claw. He sounded like the best client ever. And everything was custom-made for that project. So from that penthouse, we took three furniture. Then we have two chairs that are called the Highgate dining chairs, which in the archive only existed in photos and kind of ideas, but they were never developed. So that's when we really had to think and, I guess, put our own stamp on them. The Red Rock collection. So Red Rock was a hotel, and there was a club in the hotel called the King Solomon Cave. And all the furniture was quite low. So instead of being kind of 43 height, they're 33. And it's because the club didn't have a stage. So you had to sit quite low. And it also was in the Mediterranean. So there's sort of Mediterranean vibes. But that was the one that I was the least favorable. I had that chair in my room growing up. And so maybe that's why I kind of felt weird about it. But actually, because it's quite odd and doesn't look like your kind of typical mid-century design, it did quite well. It's standing out, yeah. And people are attracted to it because it's different.
Obviously, there's so much meaning in this collection for you personally. Yeah. What meaning do you hope that people find in it when they bring it into their own homes? Like, are there certain feelings that you hope this evokes, or are you leaving it open for people to throw their own ideas onto it?
I'm hoping that the story will resonate, that the design will resonate with their new kind of owners, and the appreciation of good design and craftsmanship, as it is with my other day job, which is architecture and kind of interior architecture. My motto is that I want to change people's lives in a positive way, whether through furniture or through designing their homes or spaces or workspaces.
That was Amos Goldrick there, and I'll be back with the Retrofit Award winner from Brazil after the break.
Become a Monocle magazine subscriber today and enjoy 10% off any annual subscription. It's time to get a truly global view that's upbeat and optimistic. With a global roster of correspondents and bureau, we deliver stories that you won't find elsewhere. Expect insights on everything from diplomacy and design to art and architecture and more. Sign up today and you'll receive 10 issues and seasonal specials full of inspiration. Visit monocle.com/subscribe and enter the code RADIO10 to redeem this offer.
The next award we're going to discuss is Best Retrofit, which went to Renata, a building in Sao Paulo. We're going to hear from the person that reported it, Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. But first, let's hear a clip from the winning architect.
Brazil's modern architecture is very relevant from a historic point of view. It invented lots of new things and it was hugely influential globally too. And so far, there's not many, still not today, ways to restore the buildings. To restore the concrete, for example, and other elements. So I think the Renata retrofit, in a way, opens the field for more restoration in such iconic buildings in Brazil.
So that was Gustavo Cedroni, one of the Metro architects that you met in Sao Paulo. Fernando, you wrote this lovely piece for the Design Awards. Firstly, welcome.
Thank you very much. And by the way, that was a fun piece to do because I knew they were going to get an award, but I couldn't really say to them.
Yeah.
It was a bit cheeky.
You feel kind of like a spy, like you're inside this building and like they don't know exactly what's going on. But I mean, tell us for starters, why is the original building actually special?
First of all, this building's special. I always admire it from a distance. But Nick, you couldn't really just go there. I think before it was a series of offices, you know, very random, you know, like not very special, even though the outside of the building is very special. It was designed by Oswaldo Bratki in the 50s. And, you know, the breeze blocks, or as we say in Brazil, cobogós, they are very typical of Brazilian architecture. So it's almost a shame that nobody was using that building. So I'm very glad that Metro Arquitetos and Planta Inc., they had this amazing project to change the utility of the building as well. So they didn't really change that much on the outside because it doesn't need much change.
And I think that the thing is, the outside is the bit that the public was familiar with it. That made it special because previously it was an office building, but they've obviously come in and completely transformed the use.
And it comes with its challenges because, as Gustavo was saying there, we have an amazing modernist architecture, but we didn't have yet the tradition to repair then or to retrofit then, right? It was a new thing. And you know, they're very relevant to architecture globally. So it's really interesting that architects like Gustavo, they are developing new techniques because there are a lot of challenges, you know, the type of material. I think to renovate concrete, he was explaining to me some of the challenges. But Nick, the cool thing about it, even if you're not staying there, you can go there and have a coffee. You can even enjoy a pool for the day user, the beautiful bar they have there. I tried their iced tea mate. Excellent.
Outstanding. I mean, this is it. So it's across the board. It's not just a beautiful renovation, but the actual use is important. And I think probably what's worth flagging is like these design awards are meant to be Monocle's benchmarks. Here are the outstanding works that we really think stand up to, I guess, scrutiny across the globe. And there are lessons for people across the globe. And I think that's what's wonderful about this. It's won the award for best retrofit, but it's really showing, I guess, a way forward for countries like Brazil, which have this, you know, abundance remnants of mid-century building stock that can then be given new life and breathe new life. I mean, were there any tips or moments or things that you picked up that you know could be applied elsewhere if you're a developer in Sydney looking to transform a building?
Absolutely. And I have to say, I had the pleasure to stay there for one night. It's funny because we are in this 50s building, but the rooms, they're so kind of breezy and modern, and it was a mix of Brazilian architecture, of course, but some Japanese minimalism as well. So, and as I said, there were challenges. They couldn't really change, for example, at the balcony, but they did such an excellent job. Every building need to have a pool as well, have a nice view. I think that's a basic standard as well.
That is sort of essential, especially in Brazil, and as an Australian as well, I feel the need for that. But I kind of want to finish with something that you wrote in the piece. You said, you know, this work is not only about preserving the country's famous architecture, but giving citizens structures to be proud of again. I mean, do you hope that this sort of approach is picked up more broadly across Brazil?
Yes, and I think it's being picked up. And Nick, just one final thing, the location of the Renata building is in downtown São Paulo, which has been through a few challenges. And Gustavo was really honest about it. There's been a lot of robbery and homelessness. The area was like almost left out, which is a shame because it's one of the most beautiful areas of São Paulo. And there are more buildings like this. This could be just the beginning, and people will be more proud of that area, which is one of my favorite areas of São Paulo, actually.
Amazing. So an amazing project that's hopefully going to be a huge catalyst in São Paulo and beyond. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. So I guess wrapping up today's show, we've still got Grace Charlton in the studio. Are there any other designers or brands that I guess you want to give a particular mention to as one of our 50 award winners that people should definitely look out for when they pick up a copy of the magazine?
I spoke to Lorena Vieira, who is a Mexico City-based architect. She's been working there for 25 years, and she founded Omet, which is another platform to champion.
We love a platform.
We love a platform to champion Mexican craft, not only Mexican designers, but also from around Latin America, but everything is made in Mexico from Oaxaca to Puebla. I'm not as interested in formulas that you can apply everywhere, wherever you are in the world. I like going to a city and feeling like I'm in a city. I mean, with Invisible Collection, they're very French. They've got that sort of eclectic modernism. Milan, I like a little bit of plastic industrial design, you know. So for me, the fact that she's got this project with Omet that is focused on really local craft and artisanship is something that really appealed to me. What about you, Nick Manise?
I don't know if I've mentioned this before for our listeners, but I'm a former landscape architect, relatively accomplished, if I do say so myself. But there's this amazing project in Istanbul where a couple of architects completely retrofitted this space beneath one of the bridges crossing the Bosphorus. It's called the Golden Horn Sports Park. This space looks amazing. It's gorgeous. There's basketball courts, skatable areas, there's walking paths, there's planting, there's like everything that you'd want in a cool urban environment. They make you physically engage with the built environment in a way that you might not necessarily get if you're just sitting on a bench in a park. Being active in our cities are a kind of an amazing way to experience them. And previously, this space beneath the bridge was completely desolate, completely abandoned. There was no connection with the waterfront. So now you can play and be in your city and actually engage with this amazing physical space on the waterfront. And I think that's what makes it special. They're the sorts of things that we're looking for in these awards. And I think as benchmarks for any project, they've got to be spaces that, I guess, speak to you, but also that maybe bring out the best in you as a person or as a community or as a city. Again, giving people a chance to physically engage and look at their city in a new way and to experience their city in a new way. And that translates, again, from this Golden Horn Sports Park right through to an amazing museum in Bahrain, which is all about telling the narrative of the pearl industry there. So we've really got an amazing spread from landscape architecture right through to museums in Bahrain.
Those are all amazing benchmarks, and we're on the hunt for more because, you know, 2025 will roll around before we know it.
Always. So, I think this is it. We're keeping an eye on the best projects over the course of a year. So really, the hunt for 2025's award winners starts now. So do drop us a line. I'm on nm@monocle.com and send us your ideas. Whether you're, you know, an architect looking for inspiration or, you know, somebody that's just looking to furnish their home with nice, well-crafted objects, I think there's something for everyone there. It's Monocle's May issue on all good newsstands now. And that's all for today's show. For more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays. My thanks to Monocle's associate editor, Grace Charlton. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylee Evans and Steph Chungu. I'm Nick Manise. Thanks for listening.